The Celestials are scary. Like, you look at them and you're like, I hate that. I don't like looking at it. But it, like, it's, I like looking, it's beautiful, but I'm also like very uncomfortable, you know?
And the guys in the Pentagon are like, get a picture of his face. Get a picture of his face. Like, that's all they cared about was like a picture of his face.
Yeah.
Right. Just, it's disturbing me if I can't see him.
Yeah, I don't like that it's just a big, got a big helmet on. Like, what the point?
Yeah, I don't see eyes, nose.
It's unpleasant. Like, what is that? I hate it.
X-Men, X-Men. In the 21st century, evil mutants led by Magneto aim to destroy the world. The only hope is X-Men.
Welcome to Cerebro, the X-Men podcast, where a homo and his friends dig deep into the history of Homo Superior. I'm your host, Connor Goldsmith, and with me today for a special bonus episode outside the usual remit of this podcast are two of the bigwigs at the Jack Kirby Museum, director Rand Hoppe and president Tom Kraft. Rand and Tom, how are you today?
Doing well. Happy to be here.
Happy to be here. Yeah, it's great, Connor.
Glad to hear it. This is the first recording I've done in 2024, which feels auspicious, I guess. I don't know. It's like, here we are. We're back at it. The holiday's over. Time to get off your ass and work. So here I am, and here you are. Thank you to Zoop for connecting us on this, because we are here to talk about the first ever Jack Kirby crowdfunded project, a hardcover printing of the Sunday strips for Sky Masters of the Space Force, a book that is probably more obscure to superhero fans who are not Kirby enthusiasts. It's a co-creation with Wally Wood, the iconic indie comics guy who, I mean, Google him if you're not familiar. He's never worked on X-Men, so people listening to this show might not be familiar, but he was a real legend, a complicated, troubled, interesting, fascinating guy. And this is an interesting project. It's their imagined version of the space race beginning 1 year after Sputnik. So, like, we hadn't actually done the American space stuff yet. So it's science fiction, but it was very, very near future science fiction that was then outmoded by what actually happened a couple years later. It kind of reminds me of, there's this show that everybody loves that I haven't watched, but they all tell me I need to watch it right now, called For All Mankind, that's like similarly an alternate space race thing. True. So fans of that might want to check it out. And of course, the Fantastic Four is also based on speculative space race stuff. Kirby is not someone I discuss that much on my show because his time with the X-Men was so brief. He was only on it for the first, I mean, technically 12 issues or 14, but like he drew the first 11. He did layouts for like 12 to 14, and then he would dip in occasionally, but it was mostly after that, Alex Toth and then Werner Roth and then Neil Adams and Jim Steranko and all of those guys. So I would say that the most significant Kirby thing I tend to bring up on my show over and over again, first of all, I'm Jewish and I talk a lot about the Jewish origins of superhero comics because I think that's really important. And Jack Kirby, nay Jacob Kurtzberg, is obviously a big part of that. But also the Kirby hat, as I call it, which is sort of my term for any of those helmets or other headdresses with the pointies and the
headgear. Fantastic. Yes.
Galactus and Hela are sort of like the ones I point. I'm like, this is the, but like anything can be. So when other designers come up with something that kind of, I'm like, you know, Chris Bocciolo designed a great Kirby hat for Magic. It's the subtlest Kirby hat you'll ever see because just two pointies on either side, right? I was like, that's the most successful Kirby hat of the 21st century. So I that is sort of his perhaps most enduring contribution to X-Men lore, is that there are all these weird helmets with pointies on them because, you know, Magneto has got one of those helmets. In fact, we just did the Juggernaut episode. My show, every episode is one character and tracks their whole history. And so we just did the Juggernaut episode and I was so confused during it because the 60s stuff is not my core wheelhouse. And my dad, who's a comic book collector, got me into comics, all that stuff, said that his favorite Kirby hat is Juggernaut's helmet. And I was like, but there's no pointies on it. So I guess it's a hat designed by Jack Kirby, but it doesn't feel like it's a Kirby hat. And then I looked it up after I recorded the episode. I felt so stupid. It's an Alex Toth design because Jack Kirby only did the layouts for that. And if you go to the layouts that he drew, which we have in pencil, it's a much more angular Kirby hat-ish helmet on Juggernaut. And
interesting.
he's even got a pointy on his nipple, which I'm like, okay, Jack, getting a little wild for 1964. But half that episode's arguing that Juggernaut's a gay character in coding. So, you know, the nipple pointies, I guess, make a lot of sense on that front. No, it made so much more sense as an Alex Toth design because it's he like Space Ghosts and all that. He loves a rounded helmet.
Yeah.
Anyway, point is, when I think of Jack Kirby, I would say probably like my first three associations, and they're probably most people in whatever order, but I would say like the Fourth World, New Gods stuff is first for me, and then Fantastic Four, and then Captain America. Like those are kind of the three things I most associate. X-Men, I think of as more of a Stan Lee joint. Of course, Arnold Drake would say that he came up with it, but I've always found that claim a little specious about Doom Patrol. Because yeah. I'm like, Doom Patrol's just Fantastic Four, though. So, like, are we really going to play this game? But, you know,
but
whatever.
It's the wheelchair, man. The wheelchair.
There's a guy in a wheelchair. I guess he ripped you off. Like, right. You know, I get that people feel certain ways about Stan over the years. But, like, that one, I'm like, okay, that's a little wacky. It came out the same year. You might need to relax a little bit. You're not the first person right. to invent a guy in a wheelchair. But anyway, I'm interested to hear more about this project, about your work with the Jack Kirby Museum. I actually went to your pop-up by the Brooklyn Bridge way back when you guys did
that. Oh, wow.
Prototype Alpha. Oh, the Williamsburg Bridge, actually. We were over on Delancey Street.
You're right. Yeah. You're right, because it was the Lower East Side. I just remember being under the bridge and being like, the pop-up is here?
That was 2013. The first one.
It was great, great fun. Yeah, I was going to say, have you guys done more of those? Because I live in LA now,
yes.
So I haven't been to any recent pop-ups you might have been doing. But if you're doing more of them, I would be happy to come if I'm in New York. Because I'm in New York. My family's here, so I'm in New York. I said here because it's New Year's, and I'm still here presently in New York.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I'm actually in Westchester, New York, which is part of the X-Men of it all.
True.
I got geographically challenged there for a minute, but yeah, I'm with you now.
Yeah. Okay. No, it's totally fine. We're new, and so I'm just sort of easing you into all these details of my life that you don't actually need to know.
Okay.
But I'd love to hear now about some details of your life. I'd like to hear about how you both became involved with the Jack Kirby Museum, your thoughts on his X-Men work, which I imagine is not what you're asked about most. Because I do think he was a big part. I mean, the Magneto design, it's still the same today because it was just that good. And I do think that the reason that Chris Claremont found Jean Grey to be such a compelling character is because of the way Kirby drew her very actively in the action sequences, even though the dialogue didn't always fit.
Right. Wasn't.
Check out the Kirby Minus Words Tumblr if you've never seen
That's
it.
Right.
It's a fascinating little feminist project.
Yes, yeah.
I'd love a little bit of your origin story with this project and with preserving this man's extremely important legacy that for so long went largely unremarked upon.
Sure. Shall I go first?
Sure.
One of you has to, so sorry, I guess. You know?
You're the director.
Allow
I'm just
me.
The president.
This is a very Stan and Jack conversation. Who's the director? Who's the president? Who goes
right,
first? Whose name is first, right? Like so.
So I've been a Kirby fan for a really long time and enjoyed when the Jack Kirby Collector first came out, when John Morrow put the Jack Kirby Collector out into the comic shops. That really kind of fortified my ideas about Jack and design and stuff like that. And I actually learned how to make a website in order to put the Jack Kirby Collector on the web. So that was like years and years ago when we didn't really even know what websites were. And I was working with John on his website. And in my non-comics life, I had a number of small nonprofits that were my clients for web design and graphic design and media. And I just was like, you know, why doesn't Jack Kirby have a small nonprofit devoted to promoting his work? Taking care of his legacy for in scholarship and for publication. So I pitched the idea to John Morrow and he thought it was a good idea. So he contacted Lisa Kirby and she said, well, that sounds great. Let's go. So we were founded in 2005. We're a virtual nonprofit. We don't have a publicly facing gallery space. But a few years after the founding, one of our members, Mr. Tom Kraft, suggested that we start building a digital archive, since the prices of Kirby art were just
impossible,
continually going up.
You're going to need a MoMA level budget to get all those. You need some rich patron of the arts to like donate
$30 million
worth of work to you. Yeah, like there's just no way.
So Tom.
But I remember seeing some of the stuff you guys do have at the pop-up, and it was just wow. Like looking at it, there's something very different about, particularly now that so much of it is digital to begin with, the art. And there's nothing wrong with that. I own artist proofs that I think are just as good as anything. But there's something really special about seeing the hand-lettered, hand-drawn, like big boards with the stuff. It's just something that it feels so weird and different, like you're looking into the past somehow, like you were there. It's nice. It feels like something that should be in a museum is the thing. So the logic makes a lot of sense to me.
And so, you were at our first pop-up. So that was first of five or
my
six,
God,
Tom?
That was 11 years
four
ago.
Or five.
It was 11 years ago. Yeah. Five, Tom, you think?
I think four.
Yeah. Okay.
No, five. You're right. Five.
Five. Yeah. So we do pop-ups, we go to Comic-Cons, we do a lot of scanning, we people bring their Kirby art to the shows. We will go to Kirby's to the fans' homes. Tom takes trips to Heritage, right, Tom?
Yeah. Yep, Texas.
So, Thomas.
Anywhere there's Kirby art, our goal is really just to archive everything we can. And you were at the pop-up, so you probably saw those interactive displays.
Yes.
Where you could flip between things.
I was wowed.
Brand just coined that phrase.
I like to call it paper-based interactivity.
That's what it is. Paper-based interactivity. I love it.
I like that kind of, museum 1.0, though. Like, because I feel like interactive displays now are like holograms that you have to scan your retina for or whatever. So I'm good on the... I'm happy to turn a page.
Just flip some pages and you can see it goes from, a Xerox of Jack's pencil work, the original art with inking and lettering
on it. Wow,
there's
Captain America. That's what he looks like. I remember this page. That's cool.
That's right. Yeah. So we've been doing stuff like that. We've helped out exhibits around the world. Scholars ask us for help with images and research, and we also help out people who are publishing. They're like, we're publishing XYZ. Do you have that? Do you have that Kirby piece? And if we do, we do. And we can help them out. So it's a great thing to be able to be in that position to serve his legacy, right? Just to keep his name out there and have a place for him that he can. People who were looking for him or on their travels, going down rabbit holes, and suddenly they find Jack Kirby, and hopefully we're providing some tasty treats along the way. Regarding,
I think that the work you've all done over the last almost 20 years has gone a long way to change the public opinion of his legacy. I mean, the thing about Jack Kirby is, in life, he didn't really get the respect until after. And part of that is because he had so many disputes with the people who own the IP, right? When you're asking for more credit and they say, actually, you should get no credit, the damnatio memoriae kind of factor of that is significant. I think that his family has also done a lot to make sure that is honored. While you guys were in operation, there was obviously the big legal dispute between them and Disney that seems to have been settled to the satisfaction of all parties.
Right.
Part of that seems to have been that he is now credited properly, or at least in a way that is defensible.
Acceptable.
Right.
Yeah.
Iconoclastic figures like that are always going to have a difficult time when they're in an environment that is inherently corporate. Even before these comics were corporatized, it was still an IP generation thing. It was work for hire. And he was always more of a dreamer, right? Like more of a person who wanted to build worlds and things. It's actually not dissimilar to exactly what Chris Claremont experienced when in 1991, after 16 years, he was told, well, actually you don't own these characters and we're going to do something else. And it's like, well, but right. Wait, I spent 16 years and I created 400 characters and I know exactly what's supposed to happen to all of them over the next 10 years. And you're telling me I'm done?
Yeah.
It's a rare medium that is like that. I mean, it's unusual. If you're a novelist, unless you die and you've left notes like Robert Jordan or whatever, they don't typically let someone else finish the story for you.
Right.
It's something that ongoing properties have that nothing else has.
Right. It's very specific with the comic industry, without a doubt, where they could just take it away from you.
I was talking to Jonathan Hickman recently on this show last year. We were talking about Apocalypse, the character, and a listener had written in to ask why Hickman and Tini Howard had emphasized Apocalypse's ancient Egyptian background and stuff over the celestial thing that has also been part of his backstory. And Hickman said that, frankly, he thinks most of the time when anyone who isn't Jack Kirby does the Celestials, it's not good. He's like, and people have done great stories. Like, but I didn't think I would. He's like, I don't want to do that. I'm not Jack Kirby. What am I doing? Like, that's his, like, unique, weird brain that created this thing. And, you know, but of course, Jonathan Hickman's dream is to write the New Gods. So clearly he's not like, I'm not going to touch any of it. But with the Celestials, he was like, ah, that's flavor. I didn't want to touch it too hard. You know, at the same time, I loved what Kieran Gillen recently did with The Eternals, which is probably the Jack Kirby project that was the least successful of the big ones. Like, they never quite managed to make it stick. I think maybe it felt too much like the Fourth World, but also not enough like the Fourth World. I don't know. But I thought that Kieran found a nice balance there. And there always is that aspirational is almost the only word I can think of for it, where, you know, ironically, it's Excelsior. It's like you're always looking upward. You're looking to the stars. There's more out there. And this story that you guys are collecting is, on some level, his first foray into that, into the promise of, I mean, I guess, is this before or after Challengers of the Unknown?
It's
Sky Masters. It's, yeah, about the same time-ish.
Very close.
It, yeah, overlaps.
I'm not an expert. So I was like, you guys are experts. So I'll ask you.
Right.
Tom, what's your Jack Kirby origin story?
Well, I started as a graphic designer after college, and I used to collect Jack Kirby comics exclusively, nothing else, before that as a teenager. And then I heard that he had died, and it made me go back into my comics and look at them and realize that what I've been missing all these years while being in college. So I eventually got into, at the design agency I was at, into web design and all that. So I created a website called What If Kirby that showed, and just like Rand, seeing the Jack Kirby collector was phenomenal, just to see Jack's pencils. And that inspired me to start trying to recreate them and have some of Jack Kirby's best inkers, like Mike Royer, Joe Sinnott, Dick Ayers, to ink the recreated pencils. So I started this whole site. And in the meantime, I was involved with the museum, coming up with the idea of doing the scanning, and eventually joined the museum. And it's been great ever since.
I'm sure, no doubt, due to your own efforts now that I remember the What If Kirby stuff, actually, now that I'm thinking, like, as I was on the, I'm 35, I'll be 36 soon, so I'm saying I'm 35 as long as possible. Because I just feel, 36 just feels like, oh, like, you're like a real grown up now, and you better have your shit together.
now you're responsible.
Right, like 35, I'm like, I'm not old, I'm 35, you know, it's the oldest I've ever been, but... but so, you know, I came up kind of on that early internet before we really knew what websites were that Rand was talking about. I mean, I had an Angel Fire page. I don't remember what was on it, but it was that kind of time, right?
Yeah.
I was like 12. I don't even remember. So, you know,
you're making me feel old.
Well, look, I mean, you know, it is what it is. You know, unfortunately, time does march on. I have listeners to this podcast who are like, oh, that's so interesting that you were reading Grant Morrison's X-Men in high school. And because like, that's the year I was born. And I'm like, I'm going to go walk into the sea. Thanks for that.
Yeah, that's right. I know.
But I think that part of what's so interesting about Jack Kirby in particular is how much his visions of the sci-fi future became indelible and timeless. Because to so many people, that imagery, the colors and the circuits and the, you know, I just like, to me, if you ask, like, what does science fiction look like? I think of like, you know, UFOs from like 50s movies and then like, a mother box. You know, it's just like kind of, like that's just kind of what yeah. it is like those little doodads and the, you know, when they did when Taika Waititi did the Thor Ragnarok movie, I was like, finally a movie that fucking looks like a Marvel comic, because
I
of
know,
all the Kirby
great.
Referencing in the
yeah.
color
colors,
schemes.
The bright colors.
There were finally colors in a Marvel movie. And then also like the backdrops and the matte paintings and stuff all had yes. that rich yeah. detailing and the sort of techno-organic almost vibe. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that, you know, someone who died when I was, I think, 6 years old had such a grip on me and has had such a grip on successive generations to the point where these adult children who speak to me about how much they like my show and they're in their 20s and they're born after 9/11 and I get very stressed. But you know, he appeals to them too. And there's something there. And there's people who feel really strongly about championing him and his legacy, even now that it is more widely recognized, his contributions to the medium and to all of these characters and properties that matter so much to so many people. There's still a real passion about, no, you don't understand how important the king was. Like, you don't get it. There are very few creators, I think, comics creators who are no longer with us who provoke that level. It feels different from the way people talk about Stan, where it's like he was everybody's grandpa. You know, like it was sort of he was the Marvel mm-hmm. face that we all grew up yeah. with. And like we miss that guy.
Promoter, marketer.
Yeah. yeah. And an incredible salesman. I mean, the best in the biz.
Yes.
Famously. But there is something about Kirby that I think speaks to the same thing that the X-Men speak to in a lot of readers, which is the idea of being overlooked or underappreciated or not quite fitting in and trying to make your own way and having this I mean, talk about a mutant power, right? Like this is someone with an artistic sensibility and ability that almost no one else has ever really had in his specific way. Like he's just so unique. I think that that idea of the mutant, of the person who society won't acknowledge because of social difficulty, you know, like mm-hmm. is something that's similar. And so even though his time on the X-Men was short, I really do think of him as very central to their initial DNA.
Yeah. And it was a reoccurring theme for Jack to do the whole idea of mutants. It wasn't something new that he just did with the X-Men. It was, there's a history behind that as well.
Well, even the Fantastic Four, right? Because the X-Men in the 60s, it's nuclear radiation that creates mutants. Claremont introduces the genetic minority element that has become so famous.
Right.
But before that, it was about the atomic age. And so it wasn't that dissimilar from Fantastic Four, where it's like, oh, the space race, cosmic rays turned us into these freaks who can't participate in polite society.
One of the things that you mentioned earlier about technology and Jack,
mm-hmm.
I actually, you know, I had the pleasure of actually interviewing him in 92.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was under the guise of a particular kind of magazine that was very interested in like virtual reality and stuff like that. That
in 1992, everybody loved virtual reality.
Come on, right?
So, and now you know, they can't even get the metaverse off the ground. You know, it turns out no one wanted virtual reality, right? Yeah.
But we decided to that, you know, all this stuff was going on and Jack did this great virtual reality story. But we were like, let's go talk to Jack about technology. One of the great lines that came out of that interview was, I tried to give technology a sense of legend.
Mm.
That was like, wow, okay, Jack. And then the other one was, I brought the technology of 30 years into the future. I always wanted the technology that my characters used to be, you know, stuff that people were talking about was going to come in 30 years. So that those were kind of like the two technology things that we were actually that he shared with us that really, you know, when I just think about his machines and like the, you know, the devices and the, you know, all the mother boxes and all, even the stuff in like what was that, Hound or something that was in Skymasters? You know, it's just, you know, it's just very, it's very, you can just see that he really liked the idea of bringing you know, the technology of the future into his stories, and to get that sense of that it was, you know, mythic.
I've talked on my show about how he clearly was influenced by, not on this early stuff, but in the Fourth World and the stuff that came afterward, Eternals and all of that, by Ira von Daniken's Chariots of the Gods. Yeah. It's actually Chariots of the Gods? But I barely say it that way. which, if people aren't familiar, is sort of one of the big ancient astronaut books that sort of was a popular fringe theory at the time that's pseudoscientific, but an interesting idea. And I don't think Kirby was like, yes, like, you know, this island is proof of aliens, the way that that book kind of says. But
right.
I think that he was really interested in the idea, what if the divine is just, it's Arthur C. Clarke, right? It's like, what if the divine, as we fail to understand it and just have fear and faith in it and about it,
yeah,
what if that's just aliens? What if that's just, you know, right. so that's part of his Thor mythos to some extent, with his version of Asgard, which is clearly like an advanced technological kind of society in some ways, right? And Journey into Mystery.
They're on a wooden Viking ship in space.
Right, yeah. And then after Chariots of the Gods in 68, you get the New Gods, the Fourth World stuff, which is like all that with the mother boxes and this and that.
Right.
It is really about making modern technology or speculative technology into something that feels old and feels mythic.
Yeah. That's right.
He did that more successfully than almost anyone I can think of. Certainly anyone who preceded him. I mean, I think that there are a lot of people who came after him who do incredible work with that motif. But to me, if you ask me, like, who was the best at achieving that strange liminal feeling, it was always him.
Yeah.
The Celestials are scary. Like, you look at them and you're like, I hate that. I don't like looking at it. But it's beautiful, but I'm also like very uncomfortable, you know?
And the guys in the Pentagon are like, get a picture of his face. Get a picture of his face. Like, that's all they cared about was like a picture of his face.
Yeah.
Right. It's disturbing me if I can't see him.
Yeah, I don't like that it's just got a big helmet on. Like, what the point is?
Yeah, I don't see eyes, nose.
It's unpleasant. Like, what is that? I hate it. Kirby also did that graphic novelization of 2001 A Space Odyssey, and the same vibe there is like, what is this monolith? We hate it. It's inexplicable. Like, what is that? Right. It's horrible. Why is it? And it's just standing there, and it's just a monolith.
Quiet, standing in silence.
Yeah, what is that? I hate this.
Yeah.
On some level, that's like God, right? Is like, if you're asking the question of like, where did we come from, and like, is there a higher power, that it's sort of like, well, if there is, it's just kind of sitting there and not saying anything to us, and like, what do we, how do we feel about that, right? It's a very, I mean, again, it's a very Jewish approach to the divine, I think, to be like, okay, we have some kind of responsibility to this ancient force, but like, I'm not really sure what it is or what it wants from me. As opposed to, I think, a lot of Christian writers, it's more about like, oh, I have to make it right with God, or like, I have, you know, this guilt about it. And here it's just sort of like, man, I don't know.
It's the big
There's
unknown.
Some kind of covenant, but nobody told me the rules, and it's got a lot of weird blinking lights on it, and I'm uncomfortable. Like, but I guess I should do something. Galactus is a very Old Testament character, right? Like, it's just sort of like, well, sometimes God shows up and eats the world, and it's just kind of, well, not personal, like,
right.
I'm hungry.
He's hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, didn't make the grade, I guess. I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah.
X-Men.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples. And now, Miss Candy Southern, and me, your host, with a message from our sponsors. Long time no see, beautiful boys and groovy gals. The summer's just beginning, and I, for one... Oh, my. That one was a whopper. What's the matter, Candy? Sorry, Connor, old sport. My allergies are just the pits this year. I'm afraid any ad for me is going to sound like it was recorded underwater. Have you tried Astapro over-the-counter nasal spray? It's the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray and starts working in 30 minutes while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray, delivering full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny, itchy nose, and sneezing. I've had terrible allergies this year, which is a bummer when you record a podcast for a living, but Astapro has kept me sounding crystal clear. It's got your back and your nose. And thank heavens for that. If you've got allergies, like me and Candy, get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com.
X-Men.
What is it about Skymasters that you found so interesting as something to collect for your first crowdfunding project?
Well, I mean, what it is it's actually a labor of love from Ferran Delgado from Spain. He is a designer, and he's been designing. He started out designing work for Marvel Comics in Spain, and now he's doing lettering work in the U.S. in American comics. But this is his dream project, was to collect Skymasters, and he's been a supporter of ours probably, I think, since the beginning. When we were founded, he reached out, and it's just great. It's like, hey, a guy from Spain, you know, sure. we love it. You know, it's great.
It's always exciting to go global. Like whenever Spotify Wrapped is like, you were streamed in 81 countries. I'm like, that's fucking insane. But like, cool. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah,
for
that
me.
That was part of the reason for the founding.
Shout out
too.
To the two listeners in Kuwait. You guys rule.
Correct. Like, so Ferran like spent all this time compiling the best copies of the Skymasters and the daily strips and the Sunday strips. And the Sunday strips are fun because they're in color and they're big. And he published in Spain the daily strips. And then he decided to publish the Sundays in English, but it was a very small edition. You can actually find this book on, you know, out there. It's hard to find, and it's expensive, his first edition.
Well, a full photo book from Spain in English is probably like a pretty limited print run.
Yeah.
I work in publishing. That would be very expensive to make.
There we go. So
yeah, but Ran, you also helped him with that whole process of bringing it to the United States, right?
I did. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I helped him. Yeah. And you know, the shipping was weird. He was, you know, wherever it was printed, he would send me, boxes of 10 books, and then I would reship them out to the people that had bought them from him. And I did some help in, you know, some of his language challenges, you know, copy editing and stuff like that. But we just realized that since it was nominated for an Eisner,
mm-hmm.
did not win. It's a lovely book. And we were approached by the guys at Zoop quite a few times at conventions. And we're like, well, you know, we actually worked something out with Ferran where we now have the English language rights to the book. So he's publishing other things in Spain, in Spanish, and he could work it out with people in France or wherever, or, you know, Portugal. But as far as English language stuff is concerned, that's our bailiwick for this project. And just the combination that, you know, the two came together. We said, well, okay, Zoop really wants to do something with us, and we've got Ferran's book.
Right.
So let's you know, put some effort into it and make it happen and see if people, you know, want to take it, you know, take in this fantastic late 50s Kirby space story.
Right.
It's a really interesting time in comics to revisit also, because it's right before Kirby and Lee invent Fantastic Four and everything that came afterwards. It's sort of the transition between the war comic or the pulp comic era of like horror comics and you know, hard sci-fi, the bridge. I mean, you can see a lot of the stuff that was brewing in his head that would become Fantastic Four. You can kind of see starting to happen. Also, I realize I keep calling it Sky Masters. Like, it's, I realize it's supposed to be a pun, but I keep calling it Sky Masters. Like, it, that's like a job to have, but it's actually Sky Masters. Like, it's the name of the character.
It's a
Sky Masters of the Space Force.
Yeah.
For the people listening, I'm like, I keep saying it like it's a job title, but it's actually like a dude, with the astronaut himself.
Yeah.
Skylar Masters, called Sky.
That's right.
That's very Claremont-y, except that if Chris Claremont invented Sky Masters of the Space Force, it would be a woman, and it would be short for, I mean, I guess it could still be short for Skylar, because he loved to give a woman a man's, he loved Lee Forrester, the ship captain, and all of that.
That's right.
But he was a big Kirby fan himself, so that mm-hmm. tracks. If this goes well, do you think that more crowdfunding projects are in the future for the museum? Because it is a nice way, you know, like you said, you can't really get the art to display it in a space because it's so prohibitively expensive and mostly owned by collectors who are really not interested in donating it. But it's a way of going beyond the digital, right? Like creating a physical object that people could buy and can have, and then the work is archived in a physical form. So I think it's an exciting idea. Do you guys have more prospects down the line, perhaps?
Absolutely. This is the first release that we're doing under the name of the Kirby Museum Press. So the idea behind that is that there would be future Kirby Museum Press books.
Very cool. Because he has so much stuff that really, I mean, leaving aside all of the work that's been destroyed because nobody thought that you should preserve comic book pencils in the 50s. It just didn't occur to anybody to do. They're like, we don't have enough paper to do that. We got to recycle this paper.
Yeah.
Leaving that aside, because every now and then something turns up that was thought lost, and that's always exciting. There's just so much stuff that's not Marvel work or DC work that therefore is not widely collected, widely disseminated, or even widely read by people who consider themselves big Jack Kirby fans. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people who love Jack Kirby and have never read Sky Masters of the Space Force. So there's something exciting about the archaeology of sort of digging up and displaying a lesser quote-unquote work that people aren't always as familiar with. So I think that more things like this would be great to have. And I think that Kirby is lucky on some level to have people who care that much 30 years after he died to get this stuff out there. It's nice. It's what every, I think, creative would hope for, right? Is that like long after you're gone, people are like, but have you read Sky Masters of the Space Force? Because no one has published it properly and I'm going to do it.
Oh, right.
What else is worth saying is that the art, it's not the typical X-Men or Marvel art. It's very detailed art, and that's a lot of it's due to Wally Wood, who was an excellent inker. He also inked for Marvel as well.
Daredevil stuff, I want to say, in the 60s.
Yep,
right?
Correct.
Yeah.
So people with a thought of, you know, a typical Kirby design, you know, drawing, will look at this in a different way, I think.
It's the backdrops that I find most sort of startling.
Oh, yeah.
They're
so stars,
detailed.
The moons, everything.
Yeah.
Because I think of that like Kirby crackle and like the sort of indistinct shapes that suggest backgrounds in a lot of Kirby's Marvel work. And then I guess because it's a newspaper strip, right? It almost looks like one of those. I mean, he had worked on Romance Comics. It almost has that kind of quality where like, it's a more realistic backdrop and like, you know, Susie and Bill are kissing in front of the Big Ben and you have to draw the whole freaking clock, like that kind of vibe of like the more photorealistic comics from back then, which is fun in a sci-fi because it really looks like, you know, I my dad loves like old B movies and stuff. And it kind of feels like watching one of those old black and white movies or a color one in the Sunday strips. But just because all of those movies, even the low budget ones, they built those fake machines. They had people standing around in real rooms. Whereas in a comic book, we might expect like, well, that background sure is blue and sort of like vaguely designating that we're like in a hangar. Here you're in the hangar. Like you can see it.
You
there's
are.
A lot of details. Yeah. And a lot of that probably is the inking because it's so lush and detailed.
Yeah, I think it was a coup for him to get Wally Wood.
Absolutely.
He was really excited about that. I think Wood was excited about it too. Wood, for until he passed, they were all he was always looking for opportunities to ink Kirby again, you know.
Well, they work beautifully together. And I mean, yeah. Kirby, the thing that's interesting about Kirby's work, I mean, there's many interesting, one thing that's interesting about Kirby's work, and this is true of anybody, but because he didn't have a super consistent inker throughout his career, it looks so, so different depending on yeah. who's, and I guess also he, because he had light pencils, like he was more of like a, here's the layout, like here are my figures, here's what I'm doing, go wild. Inking is its own thing. I'm not the inker, like, you know what you're doing. Whereas I think that a lot of artists would be like, here's how I would like it to look. Mm-hmm. And he sort of gave them a little bit more free rein with the inks. The very dark, rich, detailed inks on this were sort of surprising to me because I think of that, the brightness and the big shapes of that 60s Silver Age Kirby stuff. And it really right. does look very different, even though this is recognizably him. Like, the faces are the same, the figures look the same. But I'm like, huh, this is something different and interesting and special. And I'm excited to get it. So this collection, is it just the Sunday strips or are the dailies going to be included as well?
It is just the Sundays.
Because the dailies are better collected, is my understanding, because it's black and white.
They are easily found.
Yeah.
But I will say, Ferran is publishing right now. He's publishing a Spanish edition of the dailies. And those dailies are going to be the best looking dailies printed in the modern era. So
very cool. Who owns this property now? Does anybody, or is it like one of those things like Charlton Comics where a million people have like, where DC is like, we own Charlton Comics, but then like other people are like, do you though? Like,
yeah, it's
up in the air enough that individual people yeah. can, because it was a syndicated comic,
yes,
right? Yeah. In a newspaper.
That doesn't exist anymore.
Right. Like, that syndicate, I'm sure, has ceased to be. So, yes. And it was before yeah. the time when syndicates would cease to be because, like, Disney or Google bought them. So it's, I right. wasn't, like, absorbed yeah. into a larger conglomerate. No. That's cool, too, because it's part of, this is why what you do really is museum work. The preservation of art from the early 20th century or the first half of the 20th century. I guess this is a little after the first half, but you get what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
I did television studies in grad school, and like, we have lost almost all of that from the early television age because we don't have the yeah. tapes. They didn't keep them.
Nope.
And this is that same kind of thing. And so every little bit we have matters and is part of the legible history of this medium that now is the backbone of so much multimedia. I mean, so much of what we walk around. I mean, you know, you go to Disneyland now and there's all these kids with Jack Kirby t-shirts on, like with the art and stuff. And you're like, that's different. Like, that's very different from even when mm-hmm. I was young, you know, in the 90s and no one had heard of anyone but Wolverine and Spider-Man, right? Like, it was not...
Right.
You know, it's just, it's a very different yeah. world. And so seeing where it came from, I think, is important, just as it is with any other art form. And now that we've got 100 years of this stuff, 100 years of Jack Kirby, I mean, this is, he would be, what, 105, 106, right. something like that now?
107, yeah, 6, yeah, 106, yeah.
I'm not a math guy. I'm just like, I was vaguely around. I'm like, I know how old he was when he died. So I'm like doing vague math.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just something that I think is exciting. And I hope that this is just the first Jack Kirby Museum Press project, because I would love to see more. I would love to see his romance work collected more effectively, because I love those old romance comics. They're crazy.
Oh, they're the best. Yeah.
I love like an Apartment 3G, speaking of like a syndicated newspaper comic. Like, I love all of that wacky.
Yeah.
Or like when Stan did it again in the 70s and they did Night Nurse and all of that stuff, or like Patsy Walker, all that. Like, I think that stuff's great. And it's a shame that comics these days, because of the wild success that Kirby and Lee had with Marvel and that DC was also having with Batman and Superman and those characters, if you say comics, people think superhero comics. And there is a much vaster yeah. history.
So much more. Yeah.
And part of that was the Comics Code, obviously, saying that for decades that you couldn't make war comics or you couldn't make horror comics or things like that. You know, I just think what you guys are doing is really cool. And I was really flattered to be asked to chat about it. So thank you for that opportunity. And thank you for what you do. I think it's really key to the study of this medium, to have the material available to read, because otherwise you're just reading other people's synopses, and there's value in that too. I mean, I hope so, because my show, a lot of my show is just me summarizing right. comic books that the listeners haven't read. But I do think that there's no substitute for reading the work yourself.
It's true.
Yeah.
And thank you for inviting us.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure.
And can we just talk about Jack and the X-Men for a moment?
Absolutely. We can talk as long as you want. I don't have anywhere to be.
One of the things I do is, like, sometimes I'll do on his birthday in late August, I'll do walking tours on the Lower East Side, a place that he hated and really wanted to get out of as quickly as he could.
And even in death, never has, clearly, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, so I still bring him back. Sorry, Jack. But, you know, it's a good story, you know? But, like, one of I will often do a trivia questions, trivia contest, you know, give prizes away. And for some reason, because I'm on the Lower East Side, Jack, you know, he was living in poverty, as many, many, many people did on the Lower East Side. They were mm-hmm. squeezed in, and they were working in factories and all kinds of stuff. But when he became he played with his pals on the street, handball, trouble, got in fights with the neighboring kids.
He was a big fighter. That's one of my favorite things about Jack Kirby.
He was a fighter. Yeah, he was.
When he wanted to go downstairs from the Marvel office to go fight those Nazis outside,
yeah.
or whatever, favorite stories. He's like, I was going to beat the shit out of him.
He was fighting so much that he got on the subway and went up to the Bronx to see if they fought any differently up there. Like, he just got off the subway and, like, come on, let's go.
Well, it's very, like, Street Fighter, right? It's like you travel the world, yeah. you got to learn all of it. But, like, in this case, it's like the five boroughs. But, like, I'm sure that the styles right. were quite different and still are to this day, I'm sure, you know? I'm not much of a physical fighter myself, but I'm theorizing.
Yeah. So, but he ended up at this place called the BBR, the Boys Brotherhood Republic. And that's where he became kind of a citizen, where he was in, you know, what it meant to be civilized. and it was a place where they, you know, the boys were like self-governing. And that, I think, was the basis for both his buddies on the street and the BBR were the basis for Kirby's long interest in bickering teams of children and adults.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in my trivia questions, I'll start talking about the Newsboy Legion and
the Yancey Street Gang and
I'll ask about the Yancey Street Gang, and then I will talk about the X-Men as another kid gang from Jack Kirby.
For sure.
My
show is more focused on Claremont and what came afterward, because
sure.
I think that's when X-Men clicked for most people. And Stan and Jack would be the first people to say, like, our X-Men didn't click. But the thing that I find most fascinating about X-Men in the 60s, as someone who grew up in Westchester County and who is of a mixed Irish and Jewish background, Connor Goldsmith is sort of a self-explanatory name. It's right what it says on the tin, right?
Yeah.
There's something really fascinating about the way that the X-Men in the 60s are white kids passing for human in these suburbs. And they go to a special school that they're not supposed to tell their friends about because their friends will react to them differently. And it's all very academia focused. And it's like, it's sort of about these kids at shul.
Right.
But what's so interesting is, like, Jean Grey is this all-American girl who's like Scots-Irish or something. And then Warren Worthington is like the waspiest yacht club. Like the yacht club that Warren's parents belonged to, Jews were not allowed in, I'm sure. So just in the 60s, there's no way.
Right.
That is such an indelible part of this story. And so it's a combination of, like, when the X-Men are arguing with Professor Xavier, it's not just teens arguing with their mentor or with their authority figure. It's not just the, hey, teacher, leave us kids alone kind of vibe. It's these kids saying to the rabbi, like, we want to go out and do our own thing. And I think that mm-hmm. that is interesting too. And that's what Chris Claremont, who was also a Jewish writer, although half raised Catholic, like similarly a complicated New York mix, but he, or I guess he was born in the UK, but grew up in New York. But with Kitty Pryde, I mean, the core of the 80s X-Men becomes Kitty Pryde, looking around and going, adults are fucking crazy. Like, what is going on here? And being this Jewish girl who's like, hey, adults, like, genocide? Let's not. Could we not? That, to me, is also like a very Jack Kirby mentality.
That's cool.
It's nice to see how the torches get passed and how even someone who didn't stay on the project for very long, if they are such a unique mind. And, you know, Grant Morrison was only on X-Men for like 3 years, but 20 years later, everybody's still talking about that run in sort of a similar way, because it was like, let's reinvent the whole wheel. Like, let's just do something crazy.
Yeah.
It sticks. It really does stick. And so he comes up on my show all the time, even though, again, he only drew like 11 issues of it out of the thousands and thousands and thousands of issues that I try to cover on this show.
Yeah. That's great.
Well, you're great. Thanks for coming. I've really enjoyed this. Oh. And I'll see you at a con, I'm sure. Do you guys do San Diego? Or
just absolutely.
Okay, maybe well, I'll come bother you next time.
Excellent. Excellent. All right. We look forward to
it. And get a t-shirt.
I would love a t-shirt. I love a t-shirt moment. So we'll... Oh, that's actually really cute. Okay. I would like that specific t-shirt. So I will... And I want this book when it's ready. So send me a...
All right.
Send me the book and I will put it all over Instagram.
All right.
I don't actually have a big Instagram following, but I'll pretend that I do so that I can be like, here, look, buy this book. It's so good. Very like Vanna White, like, here's what you've won, you know?
Yeah.
I'll put on one of those cocktail dresses and be like, hey,
right,
here it is.
Right.
But thank you, guys. This has been great. This is an exciting project, and I hope it's just the first of many to come.
All right.
Thank you, Connor.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell the listeners where they can find you guys online and support the Jack Kirby Museum, support this crowdfund, links, et cetera, whatnot, because this is a nonprofit and it depends on passionate fans of this medium and this artist to keep all of this going.
Go ahead.
Our website is kirbymuseum.org. We are at Jack Kirby Museum all over most of the social media. We've been doing a lot of YouTube live streams over the last few years. We're taking a break from that right now, but we would love people to join us. And while we go through issues of Kirby's comics and share original art or scans of photo of pencils and stuff
never
like that,
seen.
Talk about his stories. Yeah. I don't have the Zoop URL. Zoop.gg, I believe.
Yes, Zoop.gg. And the project specifically is Sky Masters of the Space Force. This crowdfund campaign goes live on Tuesday the 9th, which is coming up, but you can pre-order or at least set up a pre-notification of when it will go live right now, and then it'll ping you and go, hey, we need your money now, and then you can send your money.
That's right.
But this is a great platform, the Zoop folks have reached out to me a couple times with different opportunities. I've had a couple guests on who were promoting stuff, and it's always exciting to see new avenues for crowdfunded work because God knows we need them.
Yeah.
It's true.
You can follow Cerebro on Instagram at CerebroCast. You can follow me on Instagram at Connor Goldsmith. I am no longer on Twitter, but you can find all of the episodes plus links to the Discord server, the merch store, and much, much more at CerebroCast.com, the official landing page for the podcast. For $5 a month at the House of Zaladane tier at Patreon.com/CerebroCast, you can get an ad-free version of every episode the minute they come out, plus exclusive access to the secret files, bonus episodes that are a little bit different. The Claremont read-along is resuming, and on Christmas Day, I put out the first installment of Worrying About It, my series of solo presentations about things in the X-Men franchise that I've told you not to worry about during the podcast because they're very confusing, and breaking them down for you. The first one is on the Black Womb Project, Fabian Nicieza's big sprawling conspiracy from the 90s that has become relevant again through Kieran Gillen's work in the Krakoan Age. I also have a lot of big plans for the Patreon in 2024. So please do sign up if you love the show. I am trying to make this my main thing, guys. And unfortunately, I also need to be crowdfunded. So check it out. And until next time, everybody, thank you for the support and bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone.
X-Men.
In the 21st century, evil mutants led by Magneto aim to destroy the world.